Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So I'd just like to begin by extending a very warm welcome to everybody for this Sunday afternoon talk. And what I intend to do this afternoon is just to offer some reflections that may be helpful in coming to terms with some of the more difficult things that happen within this human existence. All of us are a part of this. We've all been born, we all have these human bodies. And my sense is that coming to a monastery indicates a real sincere interest to try to find some way of understanding what it is that we've landed ourselves up in, and perhaps to making use of some of the teachings that the Buddha offered as a way of finding a place of ease and freedom in this world that, as we can see, is obviously very unsteady, unstable, unreliable. So my intention is just to share what I can from my own experience, my own reflection, and there may be things that I say that are confusing or difficult or upsetting. And if that's the case, there'll be a chance, like I'll probably talk for about an hour, perhaps something like that. And then we'll have plenty of time for people to challenge me and ask me about anything that I've said that might seem to be misleading or confusing. So I chose the topic, 9/11 and all that. For very obvious reasons, today is the anniversary of the time when the aeroplanes flew into the Twin Towers, killing something like 5,000 people. It also happens to be my nephew's birthday, so I thought, well, a nice opportunity to share some reflections and dedicate any blessing that might have accrued to him for his birthday. And obviously, more recent events have actually sort of made this even more potent as a topic. In fact, when after the events in London, I kind of was seriously thinking about changing the title. I thought, I don't think I can handle a topic that obviously is so potent. But by then it was too late. So I thought, well, let's go for it. I thought, don't be a wimp. The last couple of days, some of the community, we've been doing some recordings of the chanting that we do in the monastery quite frequently, just so that there are copies available that lay people and Sangha members can make use of if they're interested to learn the chanting or if they find it something they enjoy listening to. And the chant that we were chanting this morning is one of my favorites. It's one of the longer suttas. It's called the Fire Sermon. And it's a very powerful reflection. And basically, it goes through each of the senses, the eye, the ear, the nose, tongue, body, and mind. In Buddhism, there are six senses. We include the mind, which is interesting. And it says that each of these senses are burning. Burning with the fire of greed, burning with the fire of hatred, burning with the fire of delusion. And he gave the sermon, the occasion was a large number of fire worshippers had become interested in his teachings, and they'd come to become monks following him. And he, obviously for them, fire was a very significant symbol in their own religious practice. And so he was using the image of fire to point to something fundamental about our human existence. Basically, the prevalence of greed, hatred, and delusion, and that this is something that arises through contact with each of the senses, and also through thought, how we respond to what we see, hear, taste, touch, smell, and feel in our bodies. Burning with the fire of greed, of lust, wanting things. Like fire consumes, it wants more, and it's always taking in more. Hatred, delusion, these three fires. This is a very, very powerful image, I find, you know. And you know, when we think of it in terms of our own life as human beings, it can actually seem a bit hopeless, you know, when you consider just how much we're subject to wanting to get things that we like, reaching out, grasping, afraid of losing things that are pleasant, you know, worried about our own comforts, wanting things that are going to keep us comfortable and secure and happy, hatred of anything that might threaten or challenge that, you know, and this can be either a sort of, you know, somebody wants to take something you have, or it can be a challenge at a more subtle level to our sense of who and what we are. You know, if somebody disagrees with us, well, I speak for myself, sometimes if somebody disagrees with me, I feel like punching them. You know, there can be that strong a reaction to something, you know, even as trivial as a small disagreement. So this fire of hatred can also be very powerful, very strong. And the fire of delusion. This delusion, not seeing things clearly, not really understanding our human predicament. You know, actually imagining that there's some kind of way that we can make our life totally secure and comfortable forever. And that we can protect ourselves from any kind of harm or danger. And that there is a kind of an enduring self, which is like the basic delusion, a sense of me, who I am, and how important that is. So these three fires that the Buddha points to in this sermon are very potent when we kind of consider them in our own lives. He then goes on to say that having realized that the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind are consumed with these fires of greed, hatred, and delusion, that they are impermanent, as they say, this fire of aging, sickness, and death, that they're, none of them are last, you know, they're all fragile, fleeting. He then says that the noble, the wise, discerning disciple, at that point, he says, becomes dispassionate or disenchanted, loses the power of these desires, these longings, weakens. It has less potency. We really understand these things, you know, that they are so fleeting, that they can cause us so much pain and suffering. We begin to be a bit more wary of involving ourselves in this way. So this is like the clue as to the way out. And this is, in fact, the way of practice that we, you know, within this community and those of you who come here have taken up, is the way of investigation, to really study and understand these fires of greed, hatred, and delusion, to really understand the nature of this human existence, in order to find a way to just live with a little bit more ease and well-being, to find a different kind of security rather than the security that we rely on so much in the material world. Now, unfortunately, or maybe it's fortunate, I don't know, this is quite a... it's a very exacting kind of teaching. It's actually quite an exacting discipline. And there are not all that many who are particularly interested in taking up, say, a life of renunciation. They're not particularly interested in challenging, in questioning the values of their existence. It was in the same as in the time of the Buddha, just as it is now. You know, for in fact, when the Buddha was first enlightened, he was extremely reluctant to begin teaching, because he kind of realized that most people just wouldn't get it. You know, it just seemed hopeless. But fortunately for us, he wasn't dismayed. He did carry on. He did present his teachings, and there were people who understood and who made them real in their lives. And over the generations since the time of the Buddha, the last 2,500 years, these teachings have been passed on from generation to generation to the present time. So we have these teachings. And we live in a world where there's not such a great willingness to contemplate these things in this way. When I was, when I first thought of talking about this, I realized it was a very potent theme, and I realized that it was something that we could find a lot of useful pointers for us in our lives, ways that we can contemplate our existence. I was also a little bit overwhelmed because it did seem so vast. I was wary of plunging into something and then just getting totally lost and overwhelmed just because there wasn't a clear approach to it. And I was thinking about it just yesterday. I was thinking, well, perhaps a good approach would be just to consider it in terms of like different levels of experience, different levels of understanding. For example, there's a sort of universal level, the contemplation of the fact that we're part of humanity, and this humanity has been in existence for a very, very long time. I mean, I don't know how long, and in fact the Buddha said it was beginningless, this realm of samsara that had been rolling on for eons. And an eon is an awfully long time. And that we're just sort of part of this thing. I used to be rather idealistic in my approach to practice, because I used to imagine that if I could just practice well enough, that maybe I could somehow or other make things all right in the world. And I was enormously encouraged when I read some of the teachings of the Buddha that really give a sense of the vastness of it all. There's talking about, like in Buddhism, we talk in terms of lifetimes, that human beings, when they die, they return in some other form, either as a human or an animal or an angel or some other mode of being. And that he said that, like, for each of us, you know, if we piled up all the bones from all of our previous existences, it would be as something like as high as Mount Everest. You know, that we've been around for an awfully long time. Similarly, the amount of tears that have been wept over the loss of loved ones would fill the four great oceans. In fact, be more than the water in the oceans. Similarly, the blood that has been shed more than the water in the oceans. And really, ever since the beginning of time, there has been this ignorance that humanity has not seen clearly, and as a result of not seeing clearly, has behaved in quite appalling ways to one another. And obviously nowadays we're very much aware of what's happening to the planet. And as I said, I was strangely encouraged by this. Perhaps it brought me to my senses in just more narrowing down the scope of what, as an individual human being living at this time, I could hope to do. You know, rather than trying to make the whole world all right, just to acknowledge that the world has been this way for a long time. Countless generations of people have committed atrocities, done terrible things to one another, out of one or other of these fires, or all three of them, desire to get and to hold on to things that they want to own, to possess, to survive, really, fighting off any beings that might seem to threaten our existence, to threaten our well-being, that might want to take away things that we have. And then the whole sense of delusion, just not really seeing clearly, not really understanding, say, the fragility of our human existence, the fact that having been born we're going to die. Nobody lives forever. Strange as it may seem. So, you know, people, there has always been ignorance, and it's likely that there always will be. But for us as individuals, we have the capacity, we have the teachings to see a little bit more clearly and to live a little bit more carefully. So when we contemplate an atrocity like what happened on 9/11, more recent bombings in London, the disastrous, ghastly wars, and even contemplating the natural disasters that have happened in recent times, in some way I find it's helpful. Certainly for myself, I find it helpful, rather than seeing it as being something that is kind of particular to this time, to see it as something as a pattern, something that has existed over millennia. You know, there have been, I mean, albeit the scale of it might be different, but there have always been sort of plagues and famines and droughts and terrible illnesses and terrible wars and battles and earthquakes and volcanoes, and these things have been around since the beginning of time and are likely to continue. And that what we've seen recently is just part of that unfolding of humanity's story. So that's like looking at it in a very kind of broad, impersonal kind of way. Sort of like from a place of like looking on from very far away. As opposed to perhaps the next level, which we could see as like being the sort of social and political level. And I'm not going to talk so much about this level because I'm not really very clued up about politics. And I could probably get myself into all kinds of terrible trouble if I talk too politically, but I think it is useful to consider this level because it does explain a lot of why things happen the way they do. It also, I think, is useful to understand it, to see how it's not like an ultimate truth. And the Buddha was very emphatic about the difference between ultimate truth and conventional truth. ultimate truth is perhaps the level I was talking about before, like the sort of the grand scale of things. But human beings quite naturally organize themselves in particular ways, you know, depending on where you were born, the color of your skin, the political structure in place, your profession, religion. I mean, all of these are like conventions. And as human beings, we're very we're very eager to find an identity for ourselves. It's like this sense of selfhood is something that we take terribly seriously. And so we have our own personal identity, we have a name, we have a position in a family, we have a profession, we have national characteristics and age and so on. I mean, there are many other labels that we can give to ourselves. But also, we tend to identify with a group. You know, so there's the family group, and then there's the larger group, the nationality, the political persuasion, the religious group. You know, there's Theravada Buddhists, there's Thai forest Theravada Buddhists, there's Sri Lankan Theravada Buddhists, there's Cambodian Theravada Buddhists. There's, you know, even within Theravada Buddhism, there are different conventional labels, and then many, many labels within Christianity. In fact, I remember years ago, a French friend of mine, he said something about how in France they have 64 cheeses and one religion, whereas in Britain they have 64 religions and one cheese. which was a bit rude. And not quite true, at least not nowadays. But this way that we tend to kind of carve things up, and we identify with one group, and then everything else becomes other. And obviously each group has its own particular perks, and also sort of particular drawbacks being associated with one or other group. And this is where an awful lot of the trouble starts. This is where, yes, much of the trouble starts. I think, you know, you'd have to be a sociologist or a politician to really understand or be able to expound very clearly on the way that these things happen. But my sense is that it's this sense of identifying with a particular group to the exclusion of other groups, setting oneself apart in this way, that a lot of the conflict happens. I like to quote from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who in one of his talks he said, well, actually, in a way he thinks it's really much better for people not to have a religion, which might seem a bit shocking coming from someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama. But what he was pointing to was the fact that so often people use their religious identity as a way of setting themselves apart from another group. So he says of himself, he says, my religion is kindness. So to try to see, just again, to keep the perspective very broad, you know, to see that we're all brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death, that no human being or animal for that matter wants to suffer, that everyone is afraid of death, nobody wants to die, we'll do everything we can to protect ourselves, and this is just part of our human predicament. The difficulty starts when we separate. And it's interesting, Ajahn Sumedho sometimes points to the fact that the only reason that, like, political propaganda works, the only way that you can get people to fight against each other, is by dehumanizing the enemy. So you call them the enemy for a start. That kind of makes them immediately want to fight against the enemy. And then to find ways of making them seem other than the way that you are, separate in some way. And that's the way that, and a threat, that's the other thing, that they're a threat to your well-being and ease. And this is the way that people stir each other up and start fighting each other. Then, of course, once the fighting has happened and people have been harmed, there's a natural wish to retaliate. against them. When you're really hurting very, very badly, you don't really care who you hurt back. You just want to hurt somebody. You want to blame somebody. And this is the way that the thing escalates. This need to blame others for our unhappiness, our dis-ease, our difficulty. I was very interested yesterday. I was talking with one of the sisters who's been does a lot of work with the family camp. She works with the children and their parents when they come, and she was talking about this year's family camp and how one of the children in particular, but quite a few of the children were quite difficult. They were quite stroppy. And there was one in particular who was very, very difficult. Whereas before he hadn't been. He's actually a lovely child, and he still is a lovely child, I'm quite sure. And then, thinking about, I actually know a little bit about the family involved, and there's sort of quite major changes in the family, like the birth of another sibling, and various just changes happening in the family. And so this child, who was an only child, his position has been very, very seriously threatened and upset and disturbed. And, when you're little, you don't know who to fight. And you just fight everybody. You just thrash out at anybody. And this particular nun, Sister Chittapala, it was very nice the way she talked about it, because when you're organizing something and you want it to go well, it's quite difficult if kids are really stroppy and you're having this nice, peaceful puja and they won't join in, or they, I don't know, make rude remarks or cause problems. You can feel, a bit irritated, want to pull them into line. But she said, I could just see that they were just hurting. They were just hurting. And that was a very insightful response, I thought, probably very, very helpful to the kids. And apparently this kid, in the end, he actually gave her a present and he just threw it at her. But but just a sense that in some way her kindness had touched him. Now, unfortunately, like when we get to the political and social level, things don't really work so much that way. And it tends to be much more a matter of just clashing and brute force and trying to come to agreements and trying to find some way of reconciling, making sense, making the least mess of it. But it's very difficult once you've got into a mess to get untangled, particularly on that level, and particularly when there are so many vested interests that we can only just get a glimpse of. So it's obviously a very complex matter that we're dealing with when we're thinking about things like 9/11. And as I said, I don't really want to go into all of that, but I think just somehow reflecting around it can help us to make a bit of sense of it. So I thought lastly to talk a little bit more just about the personal level. We've talked about the universe, so we've talked about the social and political and conventional level, and then just to look at how it affects us personally, and our own response, what we can do about it. What's a suitable response when we hear of these things, when these things happen close to us, when we're actually maybe very directly affected by some disaster. What is the skillful, what would the Buddha recommend? How would he suggest that we respond when these things happen to us, or around us, or in the world? Somebody made some very strong coffee. One of the things that I think that can be quite difficult for us as human beings in this culture is to really acknowledge how we feel. You know, I've recently, I mean just in fairly recent years, made a little resolution that if I fall over, you know, supposing I trip up and fall, hurt myself, rather than leaping up immediately and saying, oh, I'm fine, everything's all right, and carrying on as if it was, I've actually made a determination to actually not get up straight away and just to sit there, even if it's in the middle of people, even if I look really stupid, just to sit there and just to absorb the pain of what's happened as a way to help the body recover, to help the being just recover, to absorb the shock of whatever it is. That's obviously a very tiny example, but my sense is that it's something that it's a principle that holds true on whatever level of things that we're talking about. As far as possible, as far as conditions allow for ourselves, to really feel what we feel. Sometimes if it's a very, very bad shock, we don't feel anything. Like one of the community, he had a very tragic event in his life and he just went completely numb. You could have stuck a pin in him, he wouldn't have felt it. And the body can go into a state of that degree of shock. So that can sometimes happen. But as far as possible, just to really feel what we're feeling. Interestingly, one of the novices, her mother has just died, and she went home to be with her mother. And she wrote, I was expecting, I mean, she was very eager to come back quickly to the community when she went. She was going to be back in a few weeks after her mother had died, but she's stayed away longer than planned. And she's actually just really using the time to go through and to feel through everything relating to her relationship with her mother and her mother's death, and making contact with other relatives, and just really, really feeling how it is in relation to this loss. And perhaps that's what each of us needs to do when we experience some kind of shock or loss. Rather than being too ready to carry on as normal, to smooth it over, to really allow ourselves to feel what we feel. So part of it may be sorrow, may be grief, may be pain, very intense pain. There may also be anger. And this is a very natural reaction. You know, sometimes people say, well, of course, you're a Buddhist, you don't get angry. And actually nothing could be further from the truth. You know, since becoming a Buddhist, I've actually experienced much more anger than I ever allowed myself to feel before. Blind rage even sometimes. And it's important that we do allow these feelings into consciousness, not with a view to expressing them, not with a view to channeling that energy to cause harm. This is very important. It's not about retaliation, but it's about actually being with our own process and using that energy. And anger is a very powerful energy, actually, and using it for reflection. We can direct it in very, very skillful ways. And you know, I've heard of a number of people who've suffered terrible loss and have been able to turn the anger, the rage, to produce a terrifically beneficial result. in society. Starting charities or doing a lot of good work to help people who've perhaps died in similar circumstances to that of their loved one. So it's not that we shouldn't feel the anger, but to try and hold it in a way that we can actually transform it rather than just retaliating. If we just retaliate, then we're no better than our aggressor. Of course, it's understandable, but it doesn't really help the thing to cease. It's interesting in community to notice how sort of minor disagreements can escalate into something quite major if we're not mindful, if we don't see what we're doing. You know, somebody hurts us and sort of says something that is upsetting to us, and so we say something mean back, and they say something, and then it just escalates. I watched this one time quite consciously with one of the sisters, and it was absolutely fascinating. And suddenly, sort of after three or four exchanges, I realized what I was doing, and I just did one long exhalation, out breath, settled into my body, my feet, and stopped throwing fuel onto the fire. Just let the thing settle. And she tried a few more times to goad me, but I wasn't going to be goaded. And when you don't feed a fire, it just naturally quietens down. Everybody comes to their senses. But when we're not mindful, it can happen very easily. The thing can escalate and get completely out of control. I find it's quite helpful to be careful also how I think about others. As I said, the mind is one of these senses that are burning with the fire of greed, with the fire of hatred, with the fire of delusion. And so, if something is happening, say, in community or in relation to a political or a religious situation, rather than solidifying the other, like nuns can solidify the monks, or men can solidify women, or Christians can solidify Muslims or Jews, or we can solidify people as a group, a group that's other. It seems to be helpful just for us all to remember our common humanity. And solidifying personalities, like the politicians. I mean, I can really go to town about some of the politicians. And I'm not sure that it's really very helpful to do that. And it's very satisfying. It's nice to feel you understand exactly, who somebody is and what they think and what they're doing and so on. But perhaps also it's helpful to consider, well, this is a human being who has an enormous responsibility, much bigger than the responsibility that I have. Tremendous power, and power might seem like something desirable, but it's also it's a difficult thing to have a lot of power. You need a lot of wisdom if you have a lot of power. So we have a chant that we do at the end of each day, where we share the blessings of our practice, with the highest gods and evil forces and the virtuous leaders of the world, all kinds of people we share our practice with. And my sense is that that's a good thing to do, that we can dedicate our practice for the welfare of these beings who do have such awesome power and responsibility. When people are relaxed, when there's a sense of ease and well-being, then they're more likely to see clearly, more likely to understand the consequences of any particular course of action, more likely to have a broader picture, to find a way to solve problems that is less harmful, or the least harmful way of solving problems. So although individually I might feel angry and upset when I think about a particular politician or somebody who seems to have done something that has caused terrible, terrible harm, or not acted quickly enough or responsibly enough, has made a mistake in response to some disaster, you know, I can easily get into a blaming mode. But as I said, I'm not sure that that's the most helpful thing, and perhaps to try to find within oneself a place of forgiveness and kindness and compassion, realizing just what a very difficult position they're in, and how probably the whole of the rest of the world is blaming them already, so they don't need me to blame them as well, to add to the heap of blame and guilt, whatever it might be. So I find this is a helpful thing to keep in mind in dealing with my own response to these things. Fear is another understandable reaction. You know, if something happens close to us, you know, particularly recent events, I could imagine that for many people it brought up tremendous fear. You know, when's it going to happen next? Where's it going to happen next? Who's it going to affect next? Will it be me? Will it be somebody close to me? And in a way, that's the way terrorism works, by kind of instilling a sense of fear in people, in the society, and really limiting people's movement and freedom just out of fear. I mean, there may be just a very small thing that's happened, but if you can get people afraid enough, then you can bring a whole country to a standstill. So how can we work with this? And my sense is it's helpful to acknowledge that there is fear. Just not to feel that we shouldn't have it. You know, if you were a good Buddhist, you wouldn't be afraid. Just as like if you were a good Buddhist, you wouldn't be angry. You know, there is fear. Fear is part of our human existence. Being a human being is a very frightening thing. We're very vulnerable. You know, we have these bodies that can go wrong at any moment, either, you know, through sickness, or there can be some accident, some disaster can happen, and, you know, the body, that the life can go out of it in an instant. And even if it doesn't happen now or in the next 5 years, inevitably, sooner or later, there'll come a time when the body ceases to exist. And that's very frightening, because we do tend to identify so very strongly with the body. We do tend to have a very strong sense of attachment to, like, people that we love. Maybe our family, maybe just people who are close to us. You know, that it seems that our life can't go on without them, or we can't be happy without them. If something happens to them, then that would be a disaster, that would be terrible. And this is natural enough. You know, we do tend to identify with these things. But the Buddha, in his wisdom, he encourages us really to challenge that sense of identity and to really reflect and consider the fact that these bodies are impermanent. All of them, every one of them, every body here is impermanent. unsatisfactory, it's not a stable, not a secure place to abide in, and it's definitely not who and what we are, essentially. Certainly, we have an intimate connection with these bodies. This is what we're lumbered with for this lifetime. And each of our bodies has a certain characteristic, has a degree of physical strength, mobility, ease and well-being, capacity. We have different gifts, we have different talents. And we can actually, you know, we can do a lot of good with these bodies for the time that we're around. And it's not to say that we shouldn't, you know, make the very best possible use of this opportunity, but to always carry it rather lightly, to keep in mind that it's impermanent, that it's changing continuously, and that's its nature. Like the Buddha talked about Dhamma as nature, the truth of things, and encouraged us to live as closely as possible to that truth, and to stay in touch with these very simple facts of our existence, rather than getting caught up in the realm of ideas, how things should be, you know, to keep our feet firmly on the ground. How are they? How is it right now? And staying in touch with the body, with its changes. Noticing the arising of anger, noticing the arising of fear. You know, when there's fear, we can notice that there's fear. Notice a tensing up in the body and just consciously breathe and relax, release the fear. Making the sense of refuge something very, very strong. Like this is something that we're encouraged to think about all the time. Refuge in awareness, like the Buddha, that which is aware, that which sees clearly. So when we're in a position of confusion or difficulty or fear, just actually being very present with that. You know, asking, how is it right now? Rather than how it should be or trying to make things all right, just to acknowledge how it is, in order to respond in the best possible way. And when we take refuge in Buddha, we're like accessing our natural wisdom, our natural understanding that can act in accordance with Dhamma, that can act in accordance with the truth of things as they are. The refuge in Sangha is the refuge in those who practice, those who have attained to understanding, like the enlightened ones. And this is helpful to consider. I mean, we might feel very far from being enlightened ourselves, but one can consider, well, how would the Buddha respond to this particular situation? How would Ajahn Chah? How would my teachers and wise friends and companions, how would they respond to this? You know, can I bring forth that in my own life, in my own practice? And actually using one another as sources of inspiration, sources of encouragement. And very often if there's a situation of difficulty, we want to do something, we want to respond straight away, and we do something immediately. But sometimes it's best just to wait a moment or two, just take a few breaths, and then see clearly, what's actually needed here. What would be the most helpful thing in response to this situation? Just taking the time to go for refuge to Buddha Dhamma Sangha rather than reacting. Another aspect of the personal response to the atrocities that we hear about, and one that I find the more I practice, it becomes more and more potent, is just to realize that the awful things that happen are things that any of us could do as well. Like if our life had turned out a little bit differently, you know, we could be, you know, strapping explosive to ourselves and going into a public, you know, a crowded place, blowing ourselves up for some cause or other. It wouldn't take very much for things to be very different. Just looking at, like, if we consider just even the five precepts, you know, to the undertaking, the training that we take on to live harmlessly, to live honestly, to be responsible with our sexuality, to be careful with our speech, to refrain from intoxication. You know, when we take these on as a way of training, which is what I would encourage everyone to do, it actually helps us to see more clearly the capacity we have to live in ways that are other than those recommended by the training. And these are actually guidelines. They're like a kind of safety net, because there will be times in our lives when we do want to hurt somebody, when we do want to say something that's not true or that's harsh or abusive, when we do want to steal, take something just because we really want it, because we feel wronged in some way, so we're just going to take it anyway. All of these impulses can arise when we're feeling insecure or uncertain or frightened. It's not beyond anybody's capacity to do the most terrible, terrible things. You know, considering this, I find, helps me to approach my response to the things I hear about in a more humble way. Even considering, like, the politicians who, you know, I can get particularly indignant about. You know, just noticing that I too make mistakes sometimes. You know, that I'm not always absolutely wise. I'm not always totally unselfish. I don't always do or say the right thing. And just to acknowledge that makes me less ready to judge or to blame. I don't mean to say these things as a way of excusing people who act out of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's not something I would ever condone or recommend or approve of, obviously, but it helps me to understand and perhaps to come out with, or to come up with a response that is more helpful than the automatic blaming or reacting or hurting back. In something that's perhaps more constructive. I notice I respond much better to encouragement than to blame. And I imagine it's the same for many people. But occasionally I do need a sharp rap on the knuckles, and perhaps that's also the same for most people. So my encouragement really this afternoon is for each of us to really consider the reality of this human existence, the fragility of it, to consider how subject we are to the energies of greed, hatred, and delusion, both within our own hearts and in the society at large, and to begin to make an effort to understand these energies in our own hearts, in our own minds and practice, and to begin to cultivate more and more degrees of kindness, of harmlessness, of compassion, and above all, wisdom and discernment, clear seeing, so that, you know, when it's time to speak sharply and firmly to somebody, we can do that. When it's time to use our influence in a way that can direct things towards a more beneficial response, we can do that, even if it means being quite clear and direct and maybe, you know, being quite fierce sometimes. That's all right if it's coming from a place of discernment. And just cultivating a sense of understanding and forgiveness and compassion, both for the aggressors and for the victims of the this world of samsara. So I think it's almost time to draw this talk to a close. There's probably a lot more things that could be said, and I look forward to responding to any of your questions and comments after we've had a cup of tea. So thank you for your attention.